This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1.
This is Bob Fetrakis in the studio here, WCRS. Last night, President Barack Obama made his case for the attack on Libya. Other things happening, the passage of House Bill 159, disenfranchising an estimated 900,000 Ohio voters, and the ongoing battle over SB 5, which, as we're sitting in the studio, may be passing. We don't know what the final version will be, but we know it will be reactionary and serve the hard right interest of the Republican Party. Let's take a look at Libya. President Barack Obama defended it on the grounds that it was in line with American values. And Connie, I'd have to agree. I think this country was founded in genocide against the Native American population, virtually destroying it. And then after the attack on the Native Americans, turned imperialism in the Spanish-American War, and has since World War II been involved with a creeping empire all around the world, involving dozens of coups d'etats and manipulation. And the attack on Libya absolutely falls in that American traditional value of empire as a way of life.
I'd have to agree with you, Bob. It seems like Americans are in love with dropping bombs on people around the country. Maybe not individual Americans. I certainly don't share that perspective. But it does not seem out of character with a United States president to just start senselessly dropping bombs on people for apparently the wrong reasons.
Well, what's interesting is supposedly we were going to do these assaults from the air to keep Gaddafi from slaughtering the civilian population of Benghazi.
So you kill people to keep people from killing people.
Well, and more than that, if it was just a no-fly zone, it'd be more tolerable, a violation of the sovereign state of Libya. But it went beyond that. At what point does it go from keeping Libyan planes from flying to destroying Gaddafi's army so that the ragtag rebels in the eastern part of that country, an area historically associated with recruitment for bin Laden and al-Qaeda, suddenly were providing air attacks, not a no-fly zone, but literally air attacks on Gaddafi's army in support of this unknown insurgent group that could very well have ties to al-Qaeda?
So United States is picking sides and stirring the turds once again, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, what you've got in this situation also, I was thinking about, since when is the United States concerned about saving Arab civilians? As a result of the first Gulf War, over 500,000 children died in Iraq and over 1 million Iraqis. We systematically bombed the water and sewage of Iraq in the first Gulf War. And then in this last war, if we look at John Hopkins Medical School, we've killed at least 750,000 Iraqis as a direct result of our invasion, a but-for document or doctrine and analysis, which you're familiar for. Had we not attacked Iraq, how many more people would be alive? If you get the line of deaths in the country and chart life expectancy, our attack on Iraq, our dismantling of their police force, our destruction of their army, our inability to secure the military depots with bombs that were unleashed on that country resulted in various Iraqis, Shias, Sunnis, Kurds killing each other, as well as the people we killed, in shock and awe. That is at least 300,000. John Hopkins says it's closer to 750,000. most likely over a million people. The United States has killed more Arab civilians than any nation in modern times.
Yeah, and certainly more than Gaddafi. So I'm interested in talking alternatives here. First, it seems like my dad was asking me about what I thought about this situation on the day that the bombings broke out. And I said, well, you know, this appears to me to be an act of aggression, which was, criminalized by the Nuremberg trials. And but the kind of justification that they're using here is intervention. But it seems to me that leaders of nations, they may well be justified in intervening when there are humanitarian crises around the world. However, it seems like bombing someone, if you need to talk to the leader of another country, why are our leaders talking with bombs? You know, what's wrong with talking with words in the old-fashioned way? So I guess I'd like to put that out to you about, you know, what kinds of alternatives Obama may have had for dealing with Gaddafi in this crisis. I mean, certainly he seems unreasonable in many ways. I'm Gaddafi, you know, that he has a history as a dictator, that he was killing people, he wanted to remain in power. But it seems like there may have been some other option besides just immediately bombing. And I do understand, you know, some of the history coming from the Democrats' perspective, you know, that in the Clinton years, President Bill Clinton was criticized heavily for not intervening more quickly in Rwanda and Yugoslavia. So I understand that he was criticized, and I think that's probably a reason why Obama just seemed to jump the gun and start bombing without trying other alternatives. Bob?
Well, I mean, one of the first things he could have done is simply had a no-fly zone. I mean, you've got mission creep already. It isn't just that they're not allowing Libyan planes to fly. They have deliberately taken the side of the rebels and targeted the army of Libya under Gaddafi. Right. That, to me, is a violation of international law. Granted, Gaddafi was a brutal dictator, and he'll point out, I was in Iraq and heard him speak to, some would say lecture, the American delegation there. I was in there in October 2009. But one point he made is that he gets thought of being a bad person because he dealt with terrorist groups like the IRA. He would point out that Bill Clinton invited the head of the IRA to the White House.
Right.
Why the double standard on terrorist groups? The United States armed, organized, funded the Mujahideen and later Al-Qaeda. Why is it the United States that can engage in all forms of support for terrorists, and we hold Gaddafi to this different standard?
So just to clarify for the listeners, Bob, you're talking about a trip that you took to Libya, if I'm correct, right?
And you actually, October of 2009.
You actually met or saw Gaddafi. You saw him speak, possibly met him. Would you, most of our listeners have, would never have the chance to go to Tripoli or Libya. And would you like to talk about that for a moment?
Well,
what was your experience?
Well,
there?
I was mainly in Tripoli. That's where the conference was. It was called the Society for the Study of the Green Book, a book written by Gaddafi. And when you're there, I mean, Libya is a beautiful country. It's got, more than 1,000 miles of undeveloped Mediterranean shoreline. It's a real jewel. It's doesn't have a lot of industry, so the water's not polluted. There was a fair amount of poverty there. The country had about 12 million people, 6 million foreign workers. Mm-hmm. Many of those, I think, very unhappy. They seemed to be doing the hardest work and trying to do day labor. Tripoli is an area that Gaddafi is very well loved in. Tripoli and Sirte, his hometown. Not in the east, Benghazi, where other tribes and other ideas flourish. But in Tripoli, he's very well regarded, and in part is because he bought everyone a house in the country. Every Libyan citizen is entitled to a house and a certain amount of income every month. But yeah, he's a dictator, and he's a brutal dictator. The broader question is the world are littered with these people. I mean, there's a very brutal theocracy in Saudi Arabia. Why don't we encourage the people there to rise up? I suspect it's because they sell us cheap oil.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've backed many brutal dictators. You know, we overthrew the second longest democracy in the Western Hemisphere, Chile, in 1973. We overthrew Allende and installed the brutal dictator Pinochet. So the United States does not have a good record in terms of these values.
Right.
And and if you go after Gaddafi, the question is, okay, you stop him from slaughtering.
Yeah.
But why are you now trying to overthrow him, and what's going to replace him?
Right.
He's brutal. He's a dictator. But we were dealing with him. He was taken off the terrorist state-sponsored terror list in 2006.
Well, there's a lot going on in the world. There are a lot of dictatorships and many governments that the United States comes into contact with and has some kind of relationship with. And, you know, there are a lot of motives, I think, that are unspoken motives when you talk about our international policy and how the United States does business and makes war and peace around the world. So it seems, you know, I know that, you know, we're all brought up here with kind of a moral sense, you know, as individuals. I'm talking about American citizens, you know, just as individuals, you know, how we're brought up to kind of have an understanding of ethics and morality, right and wrong, what have you. And it seems like I would say, you know, that there are a lot of motives of our government that we're not really fully aware of. And they try to sell us certain wars and things like that by appealing to the moral sense that we're brought up with. And they say, you know, well, there are all these people being killed by their brutal dictator. We have to step in and save them. How can we let this bully just bully them around? But oftentimes, you know, what's really going on there is that the United States government wants, you know, this group of people in power, that group of people in power. And the motives often have to do with business, money, and oil. And, you know, those are things, you know, plenty of individuals will say, you know, the root of all evil is the love of money. Well, unfortunately, I think that is what is motivating the United States government a lot of times when it makes decisions about international policy.
Key point, and we've got to analyze. Would we be in Libya if it wasn't for the oil?
Yeah. So, this is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS.
Speaking of brutal dictators, the Republican Party of Ohio has just disenfranchised an estimated 900,000 voters by requiring a driver's license, photo ID, or a state photo ID card. Now, if you're a student at The Ohio State University and you have a
student ID,
with your picture on it or address, that doesn't count because it's The Ohio State University, state-run public.
Mm-hmm.
So students can't vote with photo IDs from state colleges. They have to go down to the Driver's License Bureau, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, or some small state agency and get a state ID.
Okay.
And this is a deliberate assault, absolutely a deliberate assault
right
on elderly people, who don't have cars, are in assisted living, retirement homes, students who live on campus and don't have automobiles, poor people. We know a large percentage of those with incomes under $35,000, an estimated 15%, don't have cars and hence don't have the photo ID. This is the most restrictive photo ID in the nation, and it's the second great disenfranchisement, a deliberate attempt by the Republican Party to destroy the political base of the opposition party, the Democrats, in a two-party system where both parties are pro-corporate capitalism. So one of the least democratic countries in the world, the United States of America, decided in Ohio it would become even less democratic by denying people their right to vote.
Right. It's quite amazing. I really wonder if it's constitutional. We're not supposed to have poll taxes. These IDs do cost money. They're not free. Although many people may already have them, there are people who don't have them. And those are just the people who need to be protected from being disenfranchised. These are people who are already at risk for being disenfranchised. And they're predominantly Democrat. So,
and the homeless have a right to vote, but how many homeless have enough money to go out and buy an $8 state ID?
Well, and even if they're talking about waiving the fee requirement in some of those cases, there's still the personal investment in getting to the BMV or where, you know, to the office, you know, where it's happening, filling out the paperwork. Many people who don't have a state ID, frankly, may not be really together enough to want to fill out all the paperwork. I don't know, but they still have a right to vote. And, as citizens, we kind of have an obligation, a civic duty to vote in a way. And it's really preventing people who want to be, you know, to participate in democracy. It's really putting up barriers to that participation. And I think that's really a shame.
Well, I think the Republican Party is on the record of wanting only the right people to vote. And I do mean the right.
Yeah.
And particularly far right,
yeah.
That what they're trying to do is they don't believe the homeless should have the right to vote. They don't believe that liberal college students at public universities who voted for Obama should have the right to vote. They don't care if poor and working people who don't have cars have the right to vote. Frankly, they want those people to stay home because the only way they can win is by shrinking the electorate. Yeah. They love the fact that we have one of the lowest voter turnouts in the world. Only half our population votes in a presidential election. Yeah. And only 30-40% in congressional off-year elections, and only about 25% in the local mayoral elections. They don't want a large voter turnout.
Right.
Because the more people that turn out, the more it's reflective of the entire society, the more democratic we are in our elections, the less likely we are to embrace reactionary policies on the right, pro-corporate, quite frankly, fascistic policies on the right, illiberal policies that go against American values.
It seems it's pretty clear that Republicans don't represent everyone, that they don't even represent half of, people, the citizens here. And by citizens, I guess I also mean non-citizens as well, people who are residents in the United States and care about their civic duty. So that would also include non-citizens. But I guess so it seems like, yeah, that's the only way they can win is by cheating, committing fraud in the elections and the voting machines and disenfranchising people who would otherwise vote for the opposition.
In many ways, this is really a desperate attempt to keep Obama from winning. And I say this as somebody who didn't vote for Obama. I voted for the Green Party candidate, Cynthia McKinney. But what they realize is that Obama's going to win in 2012.
Uh-oh.
Unless they can make sure the students don't come out and vote. Unless they can make sure the elderly don't come out and vote. Unless they make sure the working poor don't come out and vote.
Thanks a lot, guys.
So we're seeing the second great disenfranchisement. Right. We're seeing the reemergence of Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And, of course, William Batchelder, the Speaker of the House in Ohio, complained that people would call it racist. It is racist. And it's also, you know, elder abuse. It's targeting the elder. It's ageism.
Yeah.
It attacks the oldest and youngest,
of
the voters.
Absolutely.
So, no, you're not simply racist, Mr. Batchelder, although you do belong to the Council on National Policy, which harbors white supremacists, a secret organization, and you might want to come out publicly on that. Mm-hmm. So you're not just racist, you're also ageist, and you're also someone who believes in class warfare. You've targeted the poor, the working poor, and the homeless. So you're the whole package, Speaker Batchelder.
Well, sounds unconstitutional to me. Moving along to Senate Bill 5, Bob, do you have any news on that?
Well, you know, we're sitting in here. They may be voting on it as we speak. Items keep coming out. One of my favorite new ones is that all college professors, full-time college professors, one of the amendments, if it passes and it's in the bill, will make us all administrators.
What does that mean?
That means we can't unionize. Or management. I'm not exactly sure who I'm administrating.
The students?
No one's underneath me. Hey, I'm an administrator. Put that cell phone away and quit texting.
A work-study student or something?
So this is another blatant attempt to take away the traditional rights. These are traditional rights of the faculty to collective bargain. So what they want to do is come in here and attack all public employees, the police, the firemen, state workers, the faculty. And then they'll say, well, this is going to save money for the state. One of my favorites is they no longer want people in the, once you're unionized and the vast majority say, let's be in a union, they no longer want workers to pay a fair share. Not to pay into the political fund, but just the fair share for the negotiation. One person complained, so they're now hoping to do away with fair share. So
she was a Tea Party
so it makes
person.
It very, very difficult for anyone to collectively bargain. They want workers, whether it's in the private sector or public sectors, not to have any leverage and bargaining rights. They like the workers to beg. Right. They don't want workers to collectively bargain and match the power of the administration, which is quite powerful at a lot of these major state universities, or to be able to even bargain with the large corporations. What they want is American workers that make the same wages as Mexican or Chinese. It's a small group of Republicans like John Kasich. I mean, quite frankly, these people come out of the 70s and 80s, the Newt Gingrich Revolution. It is the revenge of the smarmy, know-nothing, cocky frat boy. I was born white in the suburbs, and I'm entitled to all the money I can get. And anyone else, you know, liberals, black people, women, lesbians, let's go after them all. They're cocky, they're arrogant, and there's nothing on this earth John Kasich likes more than kissing large corporate ass and taking a lot of money for it. That's what he digs. That's what turns him on. And unless you understand that about these guys, they're the brown shirts. They're the shock troops for corporate fascism. They make themselves rich for the Lehman Brothers by looting the country. They make themselves rich by kissing butt for Rupert Murdoch. They get rich and they don't like other people. They don't like black people. They don't like working people. They don't like immigrants. They're arrogant. They're entitled. They're suburban. We're white bread and we're real special.
So just to clarify, do you you don't agree that it's just to balance the budget?
Yeah. What would fair share dues have to do mm-hmm. with balancing the budget.
Right.
You know, what would like, mm-hmm. okay, no, and, no benefits to this group. Okay, is that really, are those the types of things that are really going to balance the budget? Or do you have to weigh, look, nationwide, the limited, our largest employer here, pays benefits to same-sex couples. Yeah. Why? Good for business.
Yeah.
You don't want your state to be known as a Blackwater, a backwoods, you know, bunkin place where you discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation. That is not going to balance our budget. People are going to flee this state saying it's the new Mississippi. It's a backward place where people are bigoted. That's what John Kasich, the message he's bringing to the world. That is not going to help us attract intelligent, thoughtful workers. They're going to go to enlightened places with enlightened policies that promise benefits to all people.
Yeah. So I guess my my last question or comment about that is, you know, the right to contract has really, I think, been promoted, the right to engage in contract. And so taking collective bargaining away is basically taking away the right of a group of people to collectively engage in contract. I guess my question
contracts
is...
Contracts are only for the rich, Connie. Stop it.
Well, so I think like a libertarian response would be, you know, that the individuals can contract. Is that going to work for people? Are individuals actually really going to be able to bargain and use their right to contract on an individual basis to get the rights that they should have in their employment?
Mano to mano. Hi. Right. I'm a manly man. I'm going to go in and negotiate
with the corporation, right?
With General Motors.
Yeah.
You'd have to be an idiot of epic proportion
right. okay.
to believe that lie. You know, and if you exactly. were in Sweden where 96% of the workers are in union, if you came in and said, look, I'm a man. I'm going to negotiate outside
of the union.
With Saab. I've got no training. I'm a blue-collar auto worker.
But I know what I'm
going to go in
right?
and talk to Saab and their lawyers and get me a contract.
Right.
You know what
mm-hmm.
they do?
That
they
like
would
a problem.
They would give you a prescription to right. go to a psychologist to understand your underlying delusion,
yeah.
and then they'd send you down on a vacation to the French Riviera
think,
so you could rest and come back to sanity.
Yeah. Well, I think like Saab and those big companies, they don't want to bargain individually with everybody on an individual basis. They send you a contract. You cross out the parts you don't like and send it back. They don't want to deal with that. It's actually in the company's benefit to bargain collectively with a union instead of doing it individually on an individual
right.
basis everyone.
And the
That's
real
not
cost,
gonna work.
Sure, the real cost of labor isn't that much in an automobile. And I mean, what corporations really want, though, is cheap labor in China and Mexico. I mean, they don't want to collectively bargain. They want to dictate a low wage.
Well, sounds undemocratic to me. This has been Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3
102.1. Peace.
Train, I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. Stop.